It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
It was the week that was for former special counsel Robert Mueller. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. A former counsel went before two congressional panels this past Wednesday. First, it was up before the House Judiciary Committee, which homed in on issues of obstruction of justice. Then in the afternoon, it was time for the House Intelligence Committee examining a portion of the Mueller report that dealt with the question of collusion by the Trump administration, or rather campaign, with the Russians. When it was all over, the president and Republicans appeared to be pleased with the outcome. For Democrats, there apparently was a lengthy discussion of impeachment, with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi reining in her colleagues, at least for now. Take a look at the hearings and their significance. In our studio this morning, Michael Laughlin, he's a political science professor at Salisbury University, a local Republican, John Barkovich, and finally on the phone with us is Max Bergman, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He specializes in European security, U.S.-Russia relations, security assistance, and U.S. foreign policy. And welcome all to the program.
Morning.
So let me turn to you, Max, and let's start sort of in reverse order from what happened on Wednesday, which is to take a look at the Russian part of this thing. What did you make of the hearings on the issue of Russian interference and collusion?
Well, I thought one of the most significant moments of the hearing was when Robert Mueller said that Russia was currently interfering at this very moment and that it hasn't stopped. And I think that's something that we sort of forget in this whole affair. It's become sort of a whodunit mystery. But what's really at stake is U.S. national security. And what has been outlined by the Mueller investigation is that Russia did indeed interfere in our democracy in 2016, did so in a sweeping and systemic way, and is still doing it. And we have not taken strong enough action to counter that. And I think that that was one of my major takeaways and is one of the major takeaways from the report. And he identified what was so striking about his report is identified the actual individuals in Russian military intelligence units that hacked the Democratic Party and then released these emails, and identified the individuals that were behind this digital campaign in the 2016 election.
In terms of the Trump campaign, obviously they went through a series of meetings that took place, certainly the famous June meeting in 2016 with Don Jr., Kushner, Manafort, the Russia, Are You Listening? Statement by the candidate Donald Trump, Manafort's polling data, and so on. What do you make of those interactions, which I don't think we've really seen in any other campaign?
No, I mean, this is what Mueller outlined was a ton of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. And what he was simply, he established a lot of evidence pointing to conspiracy, such as the passing on of polling data. And what we have to remember is that internal polling data, this isn't just like top line numbers. This is about 60 to 70 pages with all this crosstabs and vital information. This is sort of the crown jewels that any political campaign possesses. And the Trump campaign was giving it to someone who they believed was a Russian agent, who the FBI believes is a Russian intelligence agent, who had close connections with senior Kremlin officials, with people connected with senior Russian oligarchs, connected to the Kremlin. And so why were they passing this polling data on? And it wasn't just one time. This was happening repeatedly throughout the election. And it's clear from the inference that this was about influencing the election. If this were a national security official passing classified information onto a Russian, it would be illegal. But passing polling data isn't. So Mueller needed to then try to prove that the Russians were using the information to interfere in the election. That became difficult for him to do. But what he did find was that there was all this obstruction. He found additional crimes related to the Trump campaign's desire to kind of cover up what they did during the election. And it's not only that polling data, that Trump himself directed the creation of a back channel to WikiLeaks, which was a Russian cutout. And why did he do that? Because he knew that WikiLeaks was getting stolen material from Russian military intelligence. He knew all of this. How did he know it? Because it was being reported in the press. The Trump campaign was also being informed about it by Russian intelligence cutouts, by this Maltese professor. And so all of this was taking place, and yet Trump knew about this crime, knew it was taking place, knew about Russian interference, And he didn't contact the FBI. He didn't stay away from Russians. In fact, he ran towards the crime. He deflected attention from Russia. He said that, in fact, he called on Russia to keep doing it. He said, Russia, if you're listening, try to get these 30,000 Hillary Clinton emails that were deleted. And so he was an active participant in the Russian conspiracy. Russian interference in 2016 would not have worked without Donald Trump. If Trump had said, no, thank you, don't do this, it wouldn't have been effective. But it was the fact that he campaigned on it, pointed people to WikiLeaks, pointed people to the stolen Russian content constantly. This was a major violation of U.S. democracy, and Donald Trump aided and abetted it and was complicit in this attack.
Just want to remind people exactly what it was that Robert Mueller decided as to how he approached this particular section of the investigation.
First, our investigation found that the Russian government interfered in our election in sweeping and systematic fashion. Second, the investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired with the Russian government in its election interference activities. We did not address collusion, which is not a legal term. Rather, we focused on whether the evidence was sufficient to charge any member of the campaign with taking part in a criminal conspiracy, and it was not.
John, I want to turn to you, and you have a question for Max?
Well, no, the question I would ask Max is that I thought the Russians successfully penetrated Democratic computers. Okay, that's clear. Did they not try to do the same thing to the Republican Party? Do we have any information in that regard, Max?
So there was reporting back in 2015 that the Russians did penetrate the Russian the Republican computer system, but there's no sense of what they did with any of those materials. And you know, they may have penetrated the Republican system. Maybe they've deployed, but there's been no sense of any further information on that. And I think, you know, one thing that is also clear is that this also wasn't just about the Democratic presidential campaign. They really penetrated the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the DCCC. And one of the big mysteries still of the whole investigation is Mueller noted in one of the indictments that a congressional candidate reached out to Guccifer 2.0, which is the cutout name for the Russian intelligence unit, and actually asked for the dirt that they had on their political opponent and actually got that information. And so I think there's still a lot of questions about what the Russians actually did with a lot of the materials they stole. They stole a lot of emails. They stole a lot of data that they actually didn't ever release. So what did they do with it? Maybe they did nothing with it and they just kept it, and they're using it for their own intelligence purposes. But, you know, data breaches like this are, you know, the Russians are patient. They're a large intelligence service that is carefully thinking about their next steps. And so I think that is a concern as well. And I think every political campaign, Republican or Democrat, every political party, Republican or Democrat, needs to take cybersecurity exceptionally seriously. Because the Russians have now provided a model for foreign interference and how it can be effective.
By the way, Max, can you see some of this data that, for instance, they stole back then or continue to steal, if that indeed is what they're doing, utilize then, say, for instance, against a Republican candidate if they didn't perhaps like the particular political position that they took? For instance, they might take a hard line on sanctions as opposed to what the president seemed to indicate that he was not interested necessarily in. We could see them interfering on both sides of the aisle.
100%. And there's actually evidence, and Marco Rubio, Senator Rubio, noted that during the Republican primary that there was a lot of Republican online social media activity directed against him because he, you know, had adopted a very strong line against Putin. And so, you know, the Republicans aren't partisan. That, you know, we have to remember there's this famous picture back in 2015 at a gala for Russia Today, for RT, which is the Russian state news network. And there was Mike Flynn, the president's national security advisor, sitting next to Putin. But across the table was Jill Stein of the Green Party. So you had the far left, and you had the person that would become the Republican national security advisor. So what the Russians are trying to do is sow discord in our democracy. They want us at each other's throats, Republicans and Democrats. They want to, cause chaos and division. And so, anyone who advocates a tough line vis-a-vis Russia, I think is, could be subject to the same sort of cyber interference that took place in 2016. So this is one of the major problems and dilemmas that have occurred over the last few years, is that all of this has been seen through an exceptionally partisan lens, when really this is about U.S. national security and how the Russians are trying to weaponize our partisan politics against us.
Go ahead, John, more question.
So, Max, a follow-up to that, then, is if both parties are being attacked, why is it we've seen so little action in D.C. to combat this problem?
So, to me, this is just so, it's so inexplicable on one level, and it's really explicable on the other. And what I mean by that is it's a bit like after 9/11, and we just decided not to do anything. And so it just doesn't make any sense. But then you look at, Donald Trump's positions that he has consistently advocated having improving relations with Russia. He's never strayed from that position. And so the easiest way to respond to foreign interference is to deter it. That basically you tell a country, we are the United States of America, you attack us, you are going to pay a price. It doesn't necessarily have to be a military price, but it could be an economic price. And the one thing we did see, actually, from Congress in 2017 was a strong sanctions package, a sanctions law. Unfortunately, the Trump administration has basically refused to enforce the law. They've done a few sanctions here and there, but nothing all that significant. And then currently there's a fight on Capitol Hill over election security measures. Basically, one of the things that we realized is that paper works. That using paper ballots is an incredibly important fail-safe. And we just had today, or yesterday, the Senate Intelligence Committee, the Republican-controlled Senate Intelligence Committee, found that our election systems have been under attack by Russia and by other foreign adversaries, that it's incredibly vulnerable. And yet these bills to basically provide money to states and local officials to buy paper ballots because, it's expensive and we've invested in computer technology, that bill is hung up in Congress currently by Senator Mitch McConnell. And I think it's partly because now anything related to Russia has been viewed in a partisan way, not in a national security lens. But what's critical is that we need to both take sort of action against Russia, offensive action, sanction them to deter them, but we also need to defend ourselves and improve our current democracy and our democratic defenses so that it makes it harder on them.
Michael, you have a question?
Yeah, I guess I would follow up with that. One explanation or one hypothesis is that it's a question of power at this point in time, that your analysis would lead one to conclude that presently the reason why there's no pushback from Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans is that it doesn't serve their power interest presently. Indeed, the Mueller report and the testimony that he gave reveals, of course, for the public and in a broader sense, the evidence of criminal wrongdoing in terms of obstruction of justice, collusion with the Russians, even if it doesn't rise to the threshold of conspiracy. Yet the Republic, so it's not just Donald Trump, but it's a Republican Party itself that refuses to address a violation of law and to address continued Russian interference in our elections, and perhaps will do so until and unless they see their own interests beyond Donald Trump in question. That's a proposal. I'd like your response. I'm sorry.
No, I agree, and I think it's incredibly short-sighted. We have to remember, back in 2012, Mitt Romney called Russia our greatest geopolitical foe, and he was mocked by President Obama. And I would say Mitt Romney was right. And I think it's incredibly short-sighted of Republicans now to take action or to prevent action because they sort of perceive that maybe if Russia interferes, it could be beneficial to them. Because what we've seen in other places is that, in the UK, for instance, there's a lot of rumors and links about Russian involvement in Brexit, but there's also a lot of rumors and links about Russia's support for Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the UK Labour Party. And so the Russians are not partisan. They are looking for people who will undermine the left, who will sow discord, and that could be people from the right, and it could be people from the left, that there are many, you know, left-wing pacifists that the Russians would gladly support. And in fact, in the 1980s, one of the things that we saw was the Soviets would try to infiltrate sort of the anti-nuclear movements, the sort of peace movements, because they saw that that was sort of a good way to try to undermine Ronald Reagan, someone who they were deathly afraid of. And so what we have to realize is that this is about our national security. We need to recognize who the adversary is. And the adversary is not each other. It's not Republican or Democrat. It's the foreign country that is trying to undermine our democratic process.
Let me ask you this, because one of the things that strikes me, one of the big differences between this era of Vladimir Putin and the Soviet era is that there was an ideology, communism, and everybody seemed to line up and say, this is bad, we have to oppose them, both parties did, but certainly the Republicans identified themselves as such. But that's no longer the case. There is no ideology here. It's just simply a matter of power politics, of some interest by the, for instance, the Russians. Does that make a difference in terms of how strongly, for instance, you might oppose, say, Russian foreign policy interests, as opposed to before, where there's a coherent ideology that you could say you could latch onto?
So I'm going to disagree with you a little bit.
Go ahead.
I actually think that there is an ideology at stake. This is actually a renewed Cold War in the sense, a renewed ideological conflict. And the conflict is not between, you know, Cold War is between sort of communism and free market democratic capitalism. And today I view it more as one between strongman authoritarian governments and free and open democratic countries. And what we see is that one of the things that Putin and Russia, we build up Vladimir Putin to be 10 feet tall, but actually he's very nervous about his internal position. He's worried about all these potential democratic uprisings, about people protesting in the streets. He's worried about democracy. He wants democracy to look bad. And so we're in this sort of international competition. He wants to promote strongmen leaders. And so when he sees people like the leader of Hungary, Viktor Orban, or in Poland beginning to unravel democracy, he's very supportive of that. And so we have this kind of this renewed ideological competition, and it's also not just with Russia, but potentially with China. And I think one of the things that we've been very slow to realize is that our greatest geopolitical strength is actually what we represent, is that we represent, you know, the oldest, strongest democracy. And that is something that we need to protect, and it's something that we need to do more to band with our allies to help protect our allies who are also being subjected to lots of Russian and foreign interference in their democratic processes. And so I think we've sort of entered a new sort of age of geopolitics. Maybe not to take this in too broad a discussion, but we're sort of in a post 9/11 era now. And one of the things that really worries me is that we haven't adjusted. The Trump administration hasn't focused on building relationships with its allies. In fact, has worked to undermine them, and has in fact sought to praise and promote autocratic governments like Saudi Arabia instead of taking them to task when they violate human rights. But so I think we are in a bit of an ideological struggle, and I think we have to sort of pivot to recognize that.
Do you think, though, that the lack of sharp definition of that struggle, as opposed to, say, the anti-communism struggle of the 80s and before, that makes it much more difficult.
Yeah, definitely. I think that is a major. I think that is a real problem. I also think that we tend to view the Cold War. We sort of forget the early days of the Cold War, where things also were very unclear in the late 1940s and early 1950s about, you know, where the dividing lines were. And it took a little while for things to calcify. And I sort of think we're in a similar period, and there may be more clarity. You know, I think one of the things that you would hope from an American administration would be to provide that clarity. This is actually something we talk a lot about in a podcast we do called The Asset, which goes into sort of the origins of the conflict between Russia and the United States, between Putin and the United States. But I think that we are in sort of, I think, a paradigm shift in how we view the world and how international politics is viewed. And so I think another president, another leader may provide more clarity. But right now we're sort of in this kind of nebulous period, and it leaves us very open to national security threats.
John, I want to turn to you because, well, you have a question first?
What I was going to ask Max is that his focus, obviously our focus today is on Russia.
Right.
But why is no mention on the Chinese side of this story in terms of there being a powerhouse much more economically powerful than Russia's? Russia's economy is equivalent to Kentucky's. Why do we not see action on that? Is that because the Chinese are smarter and don't get caught?
Yes.
That's kind of where I was going, but
yeah, no, that's overstated.
I didn't expect you to give up that easy.
I think there's what we see when we look at Russian and Chinese interference is very different approaches. The Russians are much more blunt. You know, the Russians want conflict with the United States, and part of the reason why they want this sort of conflict and this renewed Cold War is because they are weak. Putin longs for the glory days of the Cold War, of the Soviet Union, when it was, you know, mano a mano, when they were the superpower. And their economy has shrunk, their population has shrunk, the empire has shrunk, they've lost many of their former states. And so they want to sort of be toe-to-toe with the United States. And so they are looking to sort of cause havoc, and they want the United States to view Russia as an adversary. China's different. China is much more, is much bigger, much stronger, growing, and much more cautious. And so they're much more subtle with how they do foreign interference. They don't want to be exposed. But, you know, it was the Chinese, when I worked in the U.S. government, that hacked the Office of Personnel and Management and, you know, stole my security clearance file. You know, so the Chinese have been at this. They've been hacking and been hacking American institutions, have been stealing our technology. And if you look at Chinese aircraft, fighter jets, it looks a lot like ours, and there's a reason for that. So this is a real, you know, China is a longer-term problem, probably the bigger overall challenge to the United States. But Russia has provided a near-term, they're the ones punching us in the face directly right now. And sometimes you have to deal with a country that is punching you in the face, even if there's this sort of long-term threat.
Michael?
Let me push you just a step further in terms of anticipating future dynamics here. It's no secret, of course, that the United States itself has interfered across the world in various countries and elections and the like. So we're not, it's not as if we are the only ones we're receiving interference. We have interfered with other countries for sure. Is there, and certainly to a certain extent, the Putin adversarial relationship has emerged out of that kind of history. I was I'm interested in what kind of rapprochement we could anticipate. Your thoughts in terms of with the Chinese, but also with the Russians. Are we forever locked in this cycle of interference and counter-interference and deflection? Or do you see the possibilities of some kind of treaty of sorts, of one sort, or agreement to stop the interference? That may be Pollyannish, but no. I like your thoughts.
No, it's a good question. So what I would first say about U.S. role in foreign interference, you know, it's been heavily documented U.S. involvement, especially in the early days of the Cold War and intervening on behalf of political parties and like their Italian elections in the late 1940s, intervening in Central America and Guatemala and other places. But one of the things that happened was that we, you know, in the 1970s, we sort of said, we're not good at this, and, you know, we're backing a lot of bad apples. And so there was a lot of actual reforms that were taken on by the intelligence community. And it's one of the things that, you know, I can say with, you know, pretty high confidence that the U.S. has very little to do with any of the democratic uprisings that emerge, you know, around the world directly. And so when Putin, for instance, saw this uprising in Ukraine in 2014, he immediately blamed the CIA. But we had no idea what was actually going on. We didn't, you know, the CIA, everyone was sort of caught flat-footed. And the thing, reason why people were taking to the streets is because they were upset at their governments, not because the CIA was sort of engineering anything. So I think the U.S. involvement in foreign interference today is actually very much overstated. But as for a larger rapprochement with Russia, like, look, we're always going to have to deal with the Russians. And we always are going to have to talk with the Russians. Reagan talked to the Russians. Everyone talked to the Russians. But you need to do it from a position of strength. And I think what we need, what Trump is trying to do is just engage with Putin. His summit in Helsinki was just trying to establish better relations and work with Russia. But right now we get very little from Russia. They have very little to offer us. Their economy is basically based on oil and gas, something we have and don't really need. And they're not producing very much. They do have nuclear weapons, and that is an area where we need to continue to negotiate with them and should look to negotiate an extension, I think, of the New START arms reduction treaty and other sort of arms control-related measures. But I think the first thing to do is you need to reestablish some red lines. You need to deter them from acting against you, and then you engage in talks from a position of strength.
I want to turn to you, by the way, John, for just a moment. You're the Republican here at the table. What do you make of what all this means in terms of your own party? Your party has been very hardline in the past about Russia. Obviously, the Cold War is now receding behind us. What do you make of all of this?
Well, I think as a Republican, I'm going to say, I think what they're trying to accomplish is, as Max has said, you have to deal from strength. And in the current world situation, strength comes from your economy, from your ability to feed your people, to clothe your people, to educate your people, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think Republicans are very happy with the progress that has been accomplished in that regard. The economic strengths that have been provided in the last cycle, last 3 to 5 years at least, I'll give Obama partial credit for that. Having said that, I think that's what Republicans are focused on. They're saying, yeah, okay, we have to maintain a strength that makes us able to confront Russia, gives us the ability to confront China, gives us the ability to say to North Korea, we're not doing any more dumb deals, you know, get rid of your weapons. But that comes from strength. Strength requires an economy to support your people and your military and the force with which you want to provide throughout the world to bad actors or actors that are benefiting things that are bad for America, for democracy, and for human rights throughout the world. And so that's why I think we have, and there are multiple bad actors out there that we can only deal with from strength, and that strength comes from economic strength.
Well, let me ask you, so let me follow up. So, but in terms of the Republican Party's attitude towards Russia, do you think that's changing in any substantive way? Are we looking at something that maybe is more
I think Republicans are just as worried about Russians as Max is. I think there's a concern. I think their concern, though, is manifest in a way that's separate from the concept of, okay, that WikiLeaks is bad, but you know what, Russian warships and A-bombs and North Korea are probably worse. And so I think that's where their focus is currently on trying to make our country as strong as possible as we meet these adversaries.
Michael, what do you think about that issue, particularly as a progressive here at the table?
Well, I have to disagree with John, I think.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, it's surprising.
Max, I'm counting on you.
but I think if you say, if your claim is that the Republicans are just as worried about the Russians as, say, Democrats or the rest of us nonpartisan citizens, then why is it that Mitch McConnell refuses to bring these electoral reform bills to the Senate and to protect American elections? Because, as Max has pointed out, the fundamental attack is not on Democrats, not on Republicans, but on our democratic principles and our electoral functions that provide the basic lifeblood of American democracy. And clearly, those have been undermined, as documented by the Mueller report, and continue to proceed so that the 2020 election could very much be affected, perhaps even more forcefully by the Russians than was in the 2016 election. And the Republican Party, and I want to stress, in my view, that we're not dealing simply with Trump. We're dealing with a Republican Party that appears to be more dedicated to its power position than to democratic principles. I think that, it goes across the board. I mean, the whole vote suppression, the attempt to undermine the ability for people to register to vote, this is coming from the Republican Party, and this is in sync with their seemingly disregard for a genuine disregard for Russian interference in our elections.
John, I want to give you a moment to respond, and then we'll wrap this part of it up.
My response is from Obama, who said, and Rosenstein, the assistant attorney general, who said not a single ballot was changed. And that's the bottom line in terms of Russian involvement in the election.
Max, I want to thank you. We've been for a half hour here. He's Max Bergman. He is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and specializes in European security, U.S.-Russia relations, security assistance, and U.S. foreign policy. Appreciate you participating, Max.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you. So now I want to turn to obstruction of justice, which
the other big winner,
the other big winner there. And as a matter of fact, we'll start off with a bit of actually a bit of tape from Jerry Nadler. He is the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, grilling, of course, Bob Mueller. Let's hear a little bit about that.
The president has repeatedly claimed that your report found there was no obstruction and that it completely and totally exonerated him. But that is not what your report said, is it?
Correct. It is not what the report said.
And now, reading from page 2 of volume 2 of your report that's on the screen, you wrote, quote, "If we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state. Based on the facts and the applicable legal standards, however, we are unable to reach that judgment," close quote. Now, does that say there was no obstruction?
No.
So let me turn to you, John. First of all, how did you assess this particular part of the hearing? And separate out, by the way, what seems to be atmospherics on the one hand, that is that you seem to be a little slow in the uptake, particularly in the first few hours in terms of Robert Mueller. On the other hand,
most of the day.
Apparently picked up steam, I guess, in the afternoon,
well,
but nonetheless.
The questions became more yes or no.
Well, at any rate, as opposed to the atmospherics, what about the substantive issue about exoneration?
Well, the exoneration issue is still being batted about, and it's not clear exactly, you know, whether that's the purview of a prosecutor to provide exoneration. Prosecutors determine whether or not there was a crime, and if there was a crime, is someone capable of being proven to have committed the crime? And so just saying, well, we think there may be a crime or there may be some suggestion of a crime, but we can't really prove, and therefore he's not exonerated. Well, I don't care about exoneration. You're either guilty or not guilty, and the Mueller disposition of this question was not guilty. Now, is that exoneration? I don't know. It's certainly not guilty.
Well, of course, he didn't really say he wasn't guilty. He just simply, let's be clear about this. So what he says is, well, I see this Justice Department opinion, which says I can't indict a sitting president. He says, therefore, I'm not going to determine whether or not the president obstructed justice, right?
Okay.
That's what Mueller says. Now, obviously, Bill Barr, the attorney general, has another view of this, but that's what he says in the report. He just says,
I can't prove.
And he says, and he doesn't.
What he says.
Right.
He says, I can't prove.
He's saying he didn't try to prove it one way or the other
because.
Go ahead, Michael. Go ahead.
I think the fact of the matter simply is that the exhibits of examples of obstruction of justice were provided throughout. So the evidence is clear that anyone else beside a president would be charged with obstruction of justice. I think it's ridiculous to suggest otherwise in the light of simply that letter of 1,000 prosecutors who said, look, this is what we would conclude, that the evidence is clear, that if you are telling someone to lie about what they did, if you're trying to order the special counsel to be fired, these are obstructive acts. In the nexus of an ongoing investigation. Those are plain facts. And that, therefore, again, and the Republican Party seems to want to suggest that the president is above the law. And that's where we are at the present time.
Within the law, could the president have fired Mueller? Within the law, could President Trump have fired Mueller? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Right.
So, in the context
of this investigation, okay, that would be obstruction of justice.
Obstruction
of justice.
That
would be abuse of power. That's the point.
It's not abuse of power.
No, no, no.
If it's
absolutely
within your purview to accomplish that, it's not abuse of power, and it's not illegal.
It would be an abuse of power, yes, because of obstruction.
Okay. So let me move in and sort some of this out.
Go ahead.
So the issue becomes, okay, does the president have the ability to, say, fire, say, Jim Comey, for example,
right,
or even to fire Robert Mueller?
Right.
The answer appears to be yes,
yes,
within Article 2.
Right.
However, if he does it with a corrupt intent, i.e., for instance, to obstruct
intent,
right, to obstruct an investigation, right, then that attaches, that question attaches to the power. And if that is the case, let us assume that a president does an act which he can legally do, but is done for a purpose. Say, for instance, that the president is, say, given $1 million to fire Jim Comey, okay, because Comey's investigating something that somebody doesn't like. He has the right to fire Jim Comey, but it becomes illegal because of that quid pro quo.
Why did he fire Jim Comey? Because Jim Comey was doing a terrible job, was lying to him, number one. Why did he want, but anyway, we're talking about intent. That's
right.
You were the one that brought up intent.
Right, exactly.
So
right.
The intent is what I believe I am doing and why I'm doing it. So if you're going to prove that my intent was criminal, you better have some very, very good stuff to say that I'm Trump, I'm going to fire you, Mueller. Why are you firing me? Because you're doing a terrible job. You're spending all this money. You haven't accomplished anything. I don't think you're doing a very good job. Now, is his intent to stop the investigation or his intent to get rid of a guy who's not doing a good job? And if he says my intent is to get rid of a guy who's not doing a good job, I don't see that as being criminal. If he says to his daughter, I got to get rid of this Mueller guy because he's going to find out that I've been doing some stuff, then that's criminal intent. I agree, but that's hard to prove.
Well, I think the evidence was pointing in that direction when Donald Trump, after he had failed attempts to get Mueller fired, to get McGahn to follow through, Lewandowski to follow through, he then says, well, let's reshape the investigation. So we're going to stop investigating the 2016 election, and we're only going to investigate future elections. One is to be a fool, not to conclude that Donald Trump has corrupt intent. He does not want the 2016 election to be investigated. What else are
because
we to conclude?
Because he knew there was no collusion. He knew he was innocent, and we're spending millions of dollars. We're sending people to jail for crimes that have nothing to do with the Russians.
So the threshold now for your defense essentially is this: as long as the president says, I did nothing wrong, that is the end of the case. The president cannot be investigated. That's what you're saying.
That's exactly what you said. I did say that. And that's exactly what he said to McCann about getting, you've got to get rid of this guy because he's doing a terrible job. He should be. I don't want the executive. What did McCann say? I didn't really want to do it. Did he fire McCann? No. McCann stayed on for a year and a half after this. Did Corey Lewandowski do anything illegal going to Jeff Sessions and say, the president's really kind of nervous, thinks you ought to recuse yourself, get back in this battle for him? And criminal intent? I don't see it. Sorry.
So let me put it this way. So if I'm looking at impeachment, and we'll get to that in a moment,
if
we're looking at impeachment, should it's be forced to what you consider to be a criminal act, or should not the Congress, if you're looking at this, question whether or not this is a real reason why he did X, Y, or Z?
High crimes and misdemeanors is tough. It's in the eye of the beholder. I mean, there's no question. Impeachment is going nowhere. Democrats, I'm telling you, impeachment's going nowhere. Now, Nadler hasn't given up. Schiff actually said the only way we're going to get rid of Trump is at the ballot box. And he's probably right. This impeachment thing is going nowhere. More and more Democrats are falling off this bandwagon The issue there is that what else are the Democrats going to have to run on in 2020 except now it's Trump the bad guy, because they're not going to get Trump impeached. There's not going to be an investigation. It's not going to happen. And so what's left for them to run on? Well, we're going to run on the new Green Deal. We're going to get rid of hamburgers. We're going to get Medicare for all. We're going to have health care to illegal aliens. I mean, you know, it's on and on and on. And so I just don't see what they're going to do between now and 2020, no matter who their candidate is.
Michael, what about that?
Schiff is accurate, and I've been in agreement with John on this point, that the only way Trump is going to be removed from office is through the 2020 election. But that is because the Republican Party refuses to face the facts of the Mueller report, that this is a lawless president who has engaged in criminal activity, has betrayed the country, that he has colluded with the Russians to interfere in our elections. And the Republican Party appears to be complicit in supporting, continuing to support this particular president. Now, with regard to I disagree with you, John, in the sense that I think the possibility of impeachment is still possible. Conviction, of course, is out of the question. That's what Schiff was recognizing. But I think that the impeachment, at the very least, I think impeachment proceedings, an inquiry, is possible. And the reason for that, I think that's possible, is if the Democratic caucus in the House finally concludes that to keep the investigation alive, the inquiry is necessary, if only to win court battles, because I think mm-hmm. you would agree mm-hmm. that those are going forward.
They will go forward.
Yeah. And so it could be, pragmatically speaking, that to strengthen the hand of the Democrats in the courts to get witnesses, to get information, it will require at least opening an impeachment proceeding, even if that doesn't end in an impeachment of the president. I think that is still possible in the present dynamic. I'm not predicting it, but I think that's possible.
And in the recent polls, has there been growing groundswell in the polls for impeachment?
No.
It's been absolutely the reverse.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So that if the Democrats want to pursue this impeachment, I think that's fantastic. It'll be great for Trump in 2020 to pursue something that the American people are opposed to, not accomplish anything.
So you think it would be useful for a president to run for reelection in the face of an ongoing investigation that provides evidence again and again that this particular president has engaged in illegal activity, obstruction of justice, and colluded with the Russians? You think
The facts are there. So we've spent $22 million years. Yeah. We've had multiple people go to jail. We've seen no evidence of collusion. We put nobody in jail for doing anything with the Russians. And that's going to be a winning argument for 2020 when Trump goes forward.
So
and
we
says,
just listened to.
Those guys are just picking on me all the time and they won't get any work done.
Okay, we just listened to an expert on American Russian relations who pointed out, he provided in depth insight into the Manafort. Trump's a campaign manager providing internal polling data to the Russians, not just once, but over the course of the election. That is collusion. That is collusion. It's not conspiracy, but it is collusion at this point in time.
It's their polling data.
So you're actually implicitly saying that's okay to invite the Russians and to help the Russians interfere, because the polling data, what's critical, what Max was pointing out, which is an insight that I hadn't given a lot of thought to previously, and that is the polling data, internal polling data, is very valuable for anybody to be able then to look at the states and what is happening state by state, and how you can then, I mean, it facilitates the Russian interference program. That's what they were doing. So the impeachment inquiry would give the Democrats a platform for continuing to push that kind of information into the electoral cycle. And you are claiming that that is going to be helpful. So the Americans will then say, I want a president. I want to reelect a president who has colluded with the Russians. I want a president that really obstructs justice when he wants to. I want a president that abuses power.
That's, you'd have to prove those three things before you can use those arguments, okay? So that, hold on, so that 14 Democratic lawyers hired by an aged gentleman, okay, who's the face of this investigation, okay, and they generate... They generate 22, up to 40 million now, is the latest number I heard. Their attempts by those 14 Democratic prosecutors to get Trump results in a 488-page document that proves nothing that you've said in terms of collusion or obstruction.
And that's now, your claim,
But my opinion and the opinion of many others.
Yeah, go ahead.
But that's going to then turn the American people against Trump and the Republican Party, who have done so much for the economy, have done so much to make America great again, whether you believe that or not. And I just don't see how this continued attempt to prove something that can't be proved is going to be helpful to the Democratic Party in the next election.
I think Mike does make one good point, which is that these ideas, these charges, get into the political bloodstream. And whether or not we can debate the issue of whether this is illegal, not legal, whether they've some proved or not proved.
Understood.
It's
very complex.
Rush into it, and the simplest explanation, the simplest description of these charges will soak in. I think that's it. Because we're talking politics, we're not talking the law, right?
It's all political.
Which is bad.
The point is it's all political. None of it is legal. Exoneration is not a legal term that a prosecutor generates. I mean, this is all political. It's been political from the get-go. It'll remain political. But that's why President Trump had a big smile on his face on Thursday, because he thought he won Wednesday, and I agree with him.
I think it was more of a performance issue, but I'm going to turn to you, Michael, because I think there's something that's broader than this, which is the way that the Trump administration has dealt with these inquiries seems to establish a new line or a new standard for the appearance of administration officials on the Hill. Seems to establish new limits on on what Congress can investigate, what the administration can give up. So from an institutional point, what do you think this says about where we are with this classically 18th century document?
Yeah, I think this is an issue that hangs heavy on, in this case, the Democratic caucus, because the Republicans were in power and you had things slipped, it would hang heavily on, I think, on the Republicans in power. This is a situation where we're seeing a continued decline in the power and the authority of the Congress and its relationship to the presidency. I mean, I think that over the course of particularly the 20th century, the whole rise of the imperial presidency has been talked about in a variety of realms. And I think that what we're seeing here is just one more dimension of that, where you have a presidency now that is essentially claiming that it doesn't have to engage with the traditional oversight capabilities of the Congress. I mean, if we were to talk about the Republicans opening an impeachment investigation into Clinton, and if we were to imagine to be Clinton claiming the same kind of extraordinary refusal to provide any kind of information to the Republican House at that point in time, I suspect that the furor and frustration of the Republicans would be just as great as what the furor and the frustration of the Democrats are presently. And hence, it puts a greater pressure. If you don't use the impeachment power, one way to put it is use it or lose it. And the force of a power, in one sense, is only manifested if, in fact, it is used and implemented successfully in one fashion or another. So I think, from an institutional point of view, an institutional perspective, the Congress, the House, particularly faces a problem here. And that in one sense, they owe it to the institution, whether or not they retain power in the 2006, they owe it to the institution to push forward in the courts and perhaps even the impeachment proceeding itself. Even if it fails either in the House or clearly fails to gain any traction in the Senate.
John, what about this idea, and putting impeachment aside for a moment, but just this ability of Congress to get something out of administration? There seems to be a much higher bar than, say, ever was before. My gut tells me that it was politics and political perception that kept administration from doing the kind of thing that we're seeing done now. Obviously, the administration sees it as something of value here. But what about that difficult oversight?
Yeah, oversight belongs in the hands of Congress. Constitution clearly states that. The issue is, though, that executive powers have increased gigantuan increase in the last not just 2 years since Trump's
right.
been president.
Sure.
This is a process that's been going on from the Clinton times. Actually started with Reagan, I think, because Reagan was the first, came forward as a powerful kind of, had the people behind him, and damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, I'm running the show. And so he lost that ability as throughout his second term. But nevertheless, the point is that executive powers have increased mightily through various Republican Democratic administrations. And so the current administration has said, executive privilege, we're going to do, you can't talk to these people, they're in the White House, and that's off limits. And that has been established long before President Trump was president. President Obama used similar arguments to prevent his attorney general and IRS director and other things to, and so the point I'm trying to make is that I think, yes, our government has changed, and it's been primarily through abrogation on the part of Congress and rather than the usurpation of that power through a presidency. I think the president has become, as the Congress becomes more diametrically opposed in terms of the parties, they get less and less done. Presidents feel like they have to proceed with executive action. President Obama has done it. President Trump is doing it. And I don't think that's going to go away, whoever the president is,
but
the next cycle.
To the detriment of our democracy,
right.
Because that's, I think, part of the principle here. Again, for the oversight, I also try to emphasize in my classes that Article One is the Congress, the most powerful institution, the institution
they
that carries forward.
They control the money. They have the money.
Yeah, the institution that carries forward our fundamental democratic principle, to the extent that we've got it, it lies mainly with the Congress. So that
mainly with the House, more the House than the Senate.
Well, both have oversight capabilities.
I
would suggest, but so that for presidents ought to honor that. They should not be fighting it, even if they can. And that's part of the problem we have. It's the disrespect for the Congress, I think, grows. And it marginalizes the Congress and therefore marginalizes us, the citizens, because our fundamental access is primarily with the Congress, not with the president, fundamentally with the Congress. And to the extent that that institution's power and oversight capabilities and the respect it can get from a president or from the courts and the like, that is important to maintain any real democratic transparency of government and for ultimately the carrying out of law.
Michael, let me push this issue a bit further. Could we get to the point of, say, President Andrew Jackson, who says a Supreme Court has made a decision, now let's see them enforce it? I.e., could you see, for instance, whether it's this administration or future administrations, say, well, it's really nice, or if you can imagine Nixon saying, it's really nice that you want me to hand these over, but sorry, I'm not going to do it. There doesn't seem to be an enforcement mechanism outside of impeachment, and if a Congress is locked in this sort of binary situation, which we have obviously now, then the courts are impotent and the executive becomes even more powerful.
That's the fearful vision of future, I think, of a political dysfunction. That to the extent, I mean, we have it right now that the Congress, the House, in order to try to enforce subpoenas, they have to go to the courts, and they're relying on the third branch, a third branch of government, to assist the Congress, the House, in carrying out its constitutionally authorized powers. And that is a situation that I think is we should find quite problematic, and we should try to do what we can to reverse that going into the future.
Okay. Having said that, I'm glad you brought up Andrew Jackson. So this is not a problem that just occurred.
No, executive
power, number one. Right. Number two, having said that executive power has gotten much stronger in the last decades, I look back to the Clinton administration and a Republican Congress that worked together to get a lot of stuff done, some of which has faded since. But I mean, when you look at that Congress, that Republican Congress, and Bill Clinton, that Democratic president, they accomplished a considerable amount of stuff by working together in the bipartisan nature. So having said that, why is that not occurring now? Because I don't think we have the strength is in Congress is still divided because we have a Republican Senate and a Democratic House. Whereas when that occurred, when that symbiotic relationship occurred, it was when the Republicans controlled both sides. They controlled Congress, and Bill Clinton controlled the presidency, and they were able to get things done because they sort of from equal power. But now the congressional power is divided in some respects between the Senate and the House, no question. And that does, in fact, give the president more leeway to do stuff, okay? And it does then... Mm-hmm. The question you've raised about the third arm, which is the judiciary, we're going to see more and more of that, I think, as we progress. And I think that's going to be that'll be the key in terms of how this battle is resolved between the president and Congress. And it will be that third arm.
John, as a conservative, as somebody who believes in small government, mm-hmm. right, does not like necessarily particularly centralization from federal government. Does this accumulation of power and what we're seeing escalating, because we have seen it escalate over decades, really. Does that disturb you? And is there do you see your party at all trying to reel that back at all? Or are we, I mean, where are we?
Okay, asking a question that today is particularly bothersome for me with that question because of this kick the can down the road bill, the advancement of, you know, we're going to spend more money, we're going to get away with. So as a fiscal conservative small government person, I go, how are the Republicans voting for this? What is going on? And so that there is always that concern in the back of my mind. Are the people in D.C. as committed to small government as
you
am?
Are? I have a feeling. Well, I'll wrap this up with one from a quote from Rush Limbaugh, which was that deficits, they don't matter. That was just something we said it before. Yeah, but that's another issue. And we're talking about with John Barkovich. He's a local Republican. Also, Michael O'Loughlin. He is political science professor at Salisbury University. And also on the phone we had earlier, Max Bergman. He is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Appreciate you all joining us, having a lively discussion. No doubt we will do this again.
It was fun.
Yeah. This has been Del Mar.
Have we convinced anybody?
Well, you go out there and you let me know, John. This has been Del Marva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Del Marva Today, a production of Del Marva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Del Marva Today podcast in iTunes. Del Marva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.